Hello, everyone, and welcome to WCET Frontiers Pod, where along with passionate educational leaders, we explore practical solutions and innovations for technology-enhanced teaching and learning in higher education. I am your host, Dr. Elaine Villanueva-Bernal, STEM Digital Learning Strategist for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for WCET, and a full-time lecturer at California State University, Long Beach. Today, we have Dr. Michael Mendez, Assistant Professor of Environmental Planning and Policy at the University of California, Irvine, and a visiting scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And I'm just going to read some of the highlights from his bio. Michael has more than a decade of senior level experience in the public and private sectors, where he consulted and actively engaged in the policy making process. This included working for the California State Legislature as a senior consultant, lobbyist, and a member of the California State Mining and Geology Board, and as vice chair of the Sacramento City Planning Commission. In 2021, California Governor Gavin Newsom appointed Dr. Mendez to the Los Angeles Regional Water Quality Control Board. The board regulates water quality in the region of 11 million people. Dr. Mendez's award-winning book, Climate Change from the Streets, published by Yale University Press, provides an urgent and timely analysis of the contentious politics of incorporating environmental justice into global climate change policy. Mendez tells a timely story of people, place, and power in the context of climate change and inequality. He explores the perspectives and influence of low-income people of color bring to their advocacy work on climate change, arguing that environmental protection and improving public health are inextricably linked. Michael contends that we must incorporate local knowledge, culture, and history into policymaking to fully address the global complexities of climate change and the real threats facing our local communities. Dr. Mendez, thank you so much for being here.
Elaine, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, and I remember, I think you also were recently appointed as a Carnegie Fellow, right?
Yes, I was awarded a Carnegie Fellowship, which is one of the bigger, more prestigious endowments and awards that the social sciences and humanities can get. And it's really focused on individuals that are doing innovative work, but can also connect it to broader audiences and have a policy impact in the real world.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. So talk to us about your current projects. And I'm curious if you can talk about the intersections between science and politics that you've had to navigate.
Yes. One of my current projects, and the one that I got funding for through the Carnegie Corporation Foundation, is looking at the disparate impacts that wildfires, heat waves, drought, the compounding of multiple environmental crises are having on socially vulnerable populations. In particular, I look at the migrant community. And even within that, I narrow it down to some of the most stigmatized and marginalized populations, undocumented Latino and indigenous migrants that are often at the front line when these disasters or wildfires, heat waves, drought and other types of climactic and changing environmental decline takes effect. And I focus in California and primarily in the north and central coast region where they've been confronting high levels of these climate-induced disasters, as well where there's large populations of undocumented migrants that are working in the agricultural as well as other outdoor and tourism industries.
Yes, thank you for that introduction. And, you know, one of the biggest things that I appreciate and love about your work is how you have a pulse on climate and environmental justice issues in so many levels, so many areas, especially among historically marginalized communities. And I'm curious if you can talk to us about that process. Like, how do you have a pulse on so many things that are happening?
A lot of it stems from my own lived embodied experience, like growing up in the Northeast San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles, largely low-income, working-class, immigrant, and African-American communities that face multiple environmental threats. So I saw individuals at a very early age trying to protest and change the inequalities that they saw in their built and natural environments. You know, one of the biggest protests I remember seeing, in addition to these other environmental threats, is the landfill that was the Lopez Canyon landfill that was trying to be expanded. And community members and groups tried to protest the expansion of that landfill. And ultimately, they were unsuccessful. But that really sparked me to start to question, why did the urban environments and natural environments in which I was occupying and moving through had such environmental hazards and other environmental inequities. Ultimately, about 20 or so years later, they eventually were successful in actually pressuring policymakers to close down that landfill. And now it's been, it will continue to be remediated, but it has been cleaned up, at least the soil, to recreational levels. So now it's a skate park and other types of playgrounds that the local community can use, particularly in these areas that don't have a lot of green space and environmental justice communities. Those are primarily low-income communities of color. They're experiencing some of these environmental hazards either by historic and racial injustices in our built environments and our natural environments, or because unintentional actions that policymakers are not even thinking about these communities, and then citing noxious uses in there. So that at an early age really influenced my experience about the environment as well. My mother, who was educated, was an immigrant, but came here at an early age from Mexico, was educated in the same region, and she wanted me to have better educational opportunities. So she enrolled me and my brother and sister as well into a voluntary school busing program that was aimed to integrate schools. So I was bused to the West San Fernando Valley, which is when you watch Hollywood movies about suburbia, that particularly in the 80s, 90s, and even early 2000s.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
that was the sort of Americana of what suburbia, the ideal, where the Brady Bunch was. Where a lot of these, the Karate Kid, and a lot of these ideas of how suburbia was traveling around the world, it was based in the West San Fernando Valley. So I would wake up every morning, get on the bus, and see the changes in the environments, you know, from, you know, lack of green space, corner liquor stores and trash, even unpaved streets and sidewalks, to, you know, rolling estates, luscious lawns, a lot of green space, and communities that were really centered on providing a better quality of life. So that also awoken me to try to investigate these inequities in our built and natural environments. And that led me to urban planning, environmental policy and planning. And ever since then, I've been working in, you know, both either as a practitioner in the legislature, as you mentioned earlier, or now as a scholar and teacher, you know, delving into some of these emerging ideas that I'm meeting with various stakeholders, both in government as well as NGOs, and just trying to be on the pulse of new environmental inequities, such as climate-induced disasters for migrant communities. Idea of also being a teacher and, you know, being able to train the next generation of environmental leaders had always drove me and motivated me in my change in careers.
Yeah, I love that you share that, you know, especially your background and giving that picture of, yeah, that picturesque, you know, West San Fernando Valley, and when you tied it to, you know, those 80s movies or just 80s media, I'm just like, wow, I get that. And, you know, certainly see it here in Long Beach. We currently live in North Long Beach, and to, you know, go from there and take our children to East Long Beach schools, like you see the difference for sure. You mentioned about, you know, training the next generation of, you know, environmental justice leaders. And I was wondering if you can talk to us about that, like what's next, you know, what do you see is next as far as like training that next generation of folks?
I think you kind of led in in the previous question about how do you have the pulse on the next environmental issues? I think really as teachers, we also always can't lose sight of that, particularly in you're in the policy sciences or in the science, the natural sciences or physical sciences as well. and how around climate change and environmental issues. It's not just about knowledge production. It's about translating science into action. If it's policy action, community action, the work that we do, if we're broadly a scientist or a social scientist, we should be doing collaborative work that's human-centered and that does translate science or research into action. And I think that's the biggest idea in thriving. I've been thriving in my research and teaching and really connecting my teaching with my research and, you know, either doing providing my students with drafts of my current research, doing workshops with them on emerging research themes where I'll bring policymakers and community advocates together to study this emerging research theme. That's what I did on the migrant rights work on the wildfire. I did that also on disasters impacting the LGBTQ community. And we just started scoping it out and doing like sort of a phase one preliminary or proof of concept, whatever language or lingo you want to use. And it really, it's great to get the feedback, obviously, from the practitioners, community groups, but also the students that are looking at these issues from a different, many of them are younger, not always, but from a very different generational perspective. And that really contributes to sort of the framing of the research and teaching that we do. So I think that's really important. And within that, as you can see from the topics that I do are not traditional environmental topics. Sometimes they're controversial, from undocumented migrants to LGBTQ communities. In some circles in the environmental world, which is a very straight male, cis male, white, and other parts of the region as well, these can be very controversial issues. And, you know, I probably lost jobs, I've lost probably grants, but then I've taken risks and I have gotten other jobs and I've gotten other great grants like the Carnegie. But trying to be at the forefront of research and teaching that's inclusive, that we create the classroom and our research products and our knowledge production that is, as you said, on the pulse of new emerging environmental issues, as well as issues that students can see themselves in the classroom, in the research, in the guest speakers. Because as you know, from your teaching and your audience listeners, this generation, Generation Z, I think that's Generation Z, they're demanding that inclusivity. They really want to see themselves in both the teaching as well as the research.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, I certainly see that in the classroom, you know, especially in talking about how chemistry relates to environmental justice issues. And I love what you said around translating science into action and how students are able to see themselves in this work. And I'm curious if you could talk just a little bit more about that. You did mention that your students are looking into these, you know, controversial issues like undocumented migrant workers and then how they are heavily impacted by, climate change.
Could you repeat that again?
I'm just curious, how, if you could talk a little bit more about your students' projects. You said that students were able to see themselves, you know, in this work. And then I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about, you know, some of the projects that they've done.
Sure. I teach various environmental justice classes, environmental policy and politics, sustainability classes. So, you know, I'll teach the core, you know, kind of seminal research articles and books, or what they call from the canon of sustainability or environmental planning and policy. And, you know, providing that, you know, broad general perspective of the field.
But right,
But what's important that when we teach these general classes, that equity, justice, inclusion have to be interwoven and incorporated in all the teaching that we do. We can't just have a week of on environmental justice or gender issue. We have to do better and integrate that in many of our lesson plans. You know, sometimes it could be very difficult depending on the topic, but you know, a good part of the course should have that strong equity and inclusion, gender diversity, LGBT issues, and some of the issues that some of the topics that we're doing. So I do that when I'm teaching, you know, the canon from the broad theory or research and policy issues, but incorporating some case studies and examples as well. You know, I've taught studio-based classes or client-based classes or practicum, whatever field you're in, you use a different terminology. When essentially you have a client, it could be government. I usually do government or community, NGO. We negotiate before the start of class on issue of reciprocity, ensuring that obviously we're doing a client project that benefits that government or NGO, but at the same time, there's strong learning objectives within it, within that client question. So it has to be this form of reciprocity. And usually it's on an environmental issue, a pending environmental issue that the government or NGO is working on that has a strong equity lens. So it could be a climate action plan. It could be some type of sustainability plan or even a land use plan or general plan. Usually some type of policy, broad policy document, or initiative that they're trying to move forward. And then how does equity, how do you address the environmental issues there, as well as integrate equity and justice into the research outcome or the final product that you do for that client. So that's one project. This quarter, I'm not doing any client projects, but I'm trying something new. I'm teaching an environmental politics and policy class, and I'm having students attend a government meeting of their choice. It could be a board of supervisors. It could be a city council. It could be a state.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Okay.
It could be state or federal government meeting, but it has to be some government meeting in the United States that they're interested on a pending environmental issue and that has some kind of equity and justice angle or dimension to it. So it could be live or obviously it could be archived. And so they have to identify that, observe it, see what happens. And then, you know, they do that for two assignments. And the third final assignment for the class is doing a policy brief, a 2 to 3 page policy brief. So instead of a research paper or a long client report project, this is individual projects. First time I'm doing this, and policy briefs, 2 to 3 pages, that might sound easy, but to write a policy brief, which is shorter than a policy memo, it takes a lot of effort to write very concisely. And these policy briefs are usually taking really big research questions, distilling it to background, policy implications, key findings, and then recommendations. And you have to do that in 2 to 3 pages. And writing concisely to a policymaker, and this is aimed at policymakers and the news media. And I do this in my own work, and it's an art form. And so this is another form of communication that's quite different from a research report, a research paper, a research-based paper, and then a client-based report, which could be like 20, 30 pages that a group will do together. So this is very individual. And the students, and this I've gotten good feedback so far. The students, it's the first time they ever done that. They've done policy memos, but not such a concise synthesis of that kind of policy research. And they all agree that this is something that they want to learn how to do. So far, they all agree that this is something they want to do, and they really understand, and they're really also realizing writing in such a concise manner takes time because you're trying to get your information out there persuasively but concisely at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think students necessarily get that instruction on, like, hey, here's how you write a policy brief. Here's how to really distill things into a very concise message. And I'm curious about your student population.
We go to that, I just want to add why policy briefs are even more important than policy memos. I think everyone needs to know how to do a policy memo, but policy briefs, again, 2 to 3 pages, if you want to have take that science to action, policy makers and news reporters, they're not going to read a 30, 40 page document. Sometimes they're not going to even read a 10 page document.
Yeah. I was like, two to three pages. Yes.
Yeah. So, but you can usually get them to commit to reading the full 2 to 3 pages. So I just wanted to add that there. That's why I think in addition to research-based papers, which are very important because of methodological mm-hmm. training, or client-based reports, which are group-based and 30 to 40 pages, very important against in terms of working in a collaborative setting. But also we need to add a third stool, the policy brief, which is a synthesis of all that, of the latter.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that, you know, you're trying this with your class and then that you've gotten good feedback, because I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, within my own work with immediate colleagues, you know, in the sciences where, yeah, we teach students a lot around, you know, research papers and maybe something for a general audience, but a policy brief, does sound like a pretty productive assignment that really, you know, not forces students, but really gets students thinking about like how, like what are the most important things that I can pull from, you know, from this, you know, key concept, from that key concept, and integrating, you know, science and, you know, economics and politics together. And I got curious around what is your student demographic? Like, what are the disciplines that take your class, like the majors, right?
Let's just take this quarter. I'm teaching an undergraduate class, which mm-hmm. is environmental analysis and policy, environmental analysis and design, which is basically introduction to the key concepts and environmental issues from the policy and analysis perspective. But of mm-hmm. course, I teach heavily on the equity and justice dimensions on that. And then the second class is a graduate class in environmental politics and policy. And in my graduate class, the students are anywhere between 24 and I would say the average, like the range is 24 through probably 36, and mm-hmm. then a couple older students. But that range is probably like, you know, the average, the medium age is probably 30. And that's like, that class is, it's a smaller class, about 20 students, and very diverse, all ages and genders. Obviously, always like graduate school, we have usually more women.
Right.
So that a little bit more women in that class. And disciplines, I over the last, this is my third year at Irvine. Over the years, I started getting a little bit more the folks from the natural sciences and the other social sciences, and you know, like one or two here and there. But this my third year teaching this class. This is the first time that because I'm in urban planning department. This is the first time that out of those 20 students, I think I only have 4 planners, urban planners.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I'm a little shocked. I wish I had a little more planners, but it's also, I'm really grateful that I have all these other disciplines from the environmental sciences, environmental engineers, public policy students, mm-hmm. and then political science students, and what else? Sociology, and then anthropology. Undergraduate class, it ranges, you know, the undergraduate class is a general ed class, but UC Irvine for undergraduate classes is, you know, our student body is primarily white and Asian American, mm-hmm. API, and then African American and Latino. And then, so we're a Hispanic serving institution as well. So we do have a big Latino population.
Got it. Thank you for sharing that. And I think, in sharing the student demographic and different disciplines that are represented in your classes, I think it's just goes to show how this conversation around climate change, climate justice is very interdisciplinary and very intersectional. And that's really, I think, one of the biggest, themes that I think we really need to focus on. So with that, I want to uplift your research on how during disasters, LGBTQI plus people are more often more vulnerable because of the intersecting factors like poverty and homelessness. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, great. So I did this project. It actually started off, I used to teach at Yale for a couple of years, and I had the students do one of the research papers. And then one of my students, Leo Goldsmith, he did this amazing paper on this topic of how the LGBTQ community is disproportionately impacted by disasters, particularly how our disaster relief infrastructure, starting at the federal government to state and local governments, are really heteronormative and cisgender, and really didn't account to the uniqueness of the broad, diverse LGBTQ community. And so I read this paper, it was a graduate student, master student level paper, needed a lot of work, but it was so innovative in the topic. And I'm like, Leo, this could be a really good, a journal article on, what is the state of the field of disaster planning and policy? Because nobody has done it from the United States perspective. There have been a couple articles that had been looking at, typhoons and hurricanes around the world and kind of giving examples from other countries. But, case studies or mentions of, hurricanes and Katrina and Hurricane Sandy, but nothing comprehensive. And then a lot of these articles were in gender and culture disciplines. So that, that very kind of high theory, very speaking to other academics.
Yeah.
And nobody had written an article based on what does this look like in the United States, and focused on a strong policy analysis, meaning that gearing the research findings and the research design to practitioners, as well as obviously scholars. And so we were the first to do that. And one of the main things that we did was really strongly focus on debunking that myth of gay affluence. That really thinking that all LGBTQ communities are rich, white, fashionable men.
Like, yeah.
Well, in Grace, Queer Eye for the Straight Guys, or, any kind of gay show you'll watch on Netflix.
Yeah, I don't know. We're not all Andy Warhol, it's just, I'm just saying. So, yeah.
Yeah. And so about a quarter of the LGBTQ population, maybe a little less or about a quarter, identify as people of color. Mm. And there's 11 million, I think it was 11 or 14 million, I have to look that again, LGBTQ people around the country that identify, and they live in every county in the country, both urban and rural. They're just not in big cities, and increasingly you see, because of housing choices, LGBT people want to be out in more suburban and rural areas. They're moving to all places in our country, and so we really want to highlight that some of the same vulnerability factors that render some people to be considered vulnerable to disasters, such as low income, your race, your education levels, your healthcare status. If you dive into the statistics for LGBT people, particularly that intersectional approach you were mentioning earlier, you see that many of them, particularly African-American trans women or African-American transgender-identified individuals are homeless, they're low income, they don't have health care, low levels of education, high levels of incarceration as well. And so these are the same very factors that make other people absent, just taking out LGBT sexual orientation or being part of the LGBTQ community already makes them vulnerable. So add that intersectional layer of being LGBTQ, and so you see heightened risks. And so our paper identifies that as well.
Yeah, and I was watching, I watched a little bit of the panel that you hosted on YouTube, The Queer and Present Danger. And the numbers, I mean, the facts, the statistics are just so disheartening that, yeah, you have like marginalized communities, especially within the LGBTQ community, that are just largely ignored You know, when it comes to disaster response, when it comes to any policy. And I do like the solutions that you folks had proposed, especially in utilizing, you know, LGBT centers, as far as like resources, right, during those times. So yeah, so thank you for doing that. And just speaking of that, you know, the, online presence, YouTube, I do see that you have a significant online presence in sharing your work and research, especially like Twitter, YouTube, podcast. And I'm curious, how have these digital spaces facilitated education around these emergent issues that you present in your work?
They have been able to help amplify the work and that I've been doing around these research work, as well as my teaching around these issues. A great forum, Twitter in particular, has been a great academic Twitter, I guess, as you call it, has been a great platform to get these issues out and to get it amplified. Mm-hmm. And so rather than engaging on debates or dialogue on Twitter, I just have been putting out my research there. And because it's innovative, I've co-authored with some of this research with community groups. People are interested because it really takes that human-centered approach to these issues of climate change, climate-induced disasters, vulnerability, disparate impacts. And I've been very grateful that people have been interested in that work. It's, you know, compared to other scholars, you know, my profile might be medium, but, you know, over the last 2-3 years, it's been increasing on Twitter because of this engagement and really trying to put that information that I'm doing with these community groups out there and other people retweeting it. And it's getting to people that I normally wouldn't have any connection to. So it provides an opportunity to network and learn from other people, get to speak to other policymakers that see it. They contact me sometimes, news reporters as well, particularly on doing policy briefs and being very concise in sort of the research findings. It has really connected me to other news reporters, both in print, online, as mm-hmm. well as broadcast.
Yeah, and I think your research, your work is so timely. And I think, and it's like what you had in one of the messages in your book, where, you know, so many communities have gone largely ignored in this conversation on climate change. And so I think that's why, you know, you're getting so much traction. And again, you know, thank you so much for, you know, sharing your experiences with us so far and everything, and also highlighting some of the you know, again, very timely, very important work that you've done. So my final question, last question, is what's next? You know, like, how do we continue this conversation, especially in these digital spaces? Like, what, you know, how do we move forward?
With work in general, or with research work next, or what?
In general, and also, you know, and if you'd like to specify your research work, yeah.
I think just academics not being afraid to have public-facing work. You know, that's maybe I embraced it more because I came to academia as a second career, and I did mm-hmm. work, 10 years or so or more in Sacramento and policy-related work, legislative work. So I've always seen the value of translating our research into action, into having policy implications, trying to synthesize that to broader audiences. So I think the next thing is first for academia to acknowledge that and to value that in our merit and promotion mm-hmm. of public-facing research, of community-engaged research, of research into action, as I mentioned. And I think that needs to be valued. As I mentioned before, I've enjoyed it. This has been my passion, but there are risks. Like I said, you know,
yeah.
I've lost jobs before because I'm doing innovative, sometimes controversial work. I probably didn't get grants because of the very same nature of maybe more conservative peer reviewers on the grant committee mm-hmm. or the faculty search committee. But I with every risk, there's also big rewards as well. Those times that I didn't get those, I also I got the Carnegie, I got an NSF
early yes. year,
faculty award. So at the same time, really grateful to see how things are changing. It's slowly, but it's changing. And I'm able to do some of this controversial or innovative work. Depends on which, you know, what circle you're in. It's controversial or it's innovative. I'm able to do it a little bit more because I am a little now protected because I've gotten, I wouldn't say protected, but I have a little bit more leeway.
Yes.
Because I've gotten some of these prestigious awards. So it's sort of, good or bad, it's sort of validated the work that I've done. But but when you're starting off, it's scary to do this type of work. Like I said, you don't know the faculty prospect of landing a tenure track job at a top university or any university is really hard. Every individual research has to take, understand that, you know, there are some risks of that. So the next steps is academia to acknowledge this for faculty and aspiring faculty members, PhD students, graduate students, to go with their passion. And if this is something that they want to do, they should do it. Things are changing. They're slowly, but things are changing. And, you know, opening up spaces for this type of research and public-facing, community-engaged research, being more vocal, but putting your research on academic Twitter and other public-facing mediums and platforms.
Wow. Thank you so much for that, Dr. Mendez. And I think just, you know, in closing, you know, thank you for sharing, the different areas of your work and how it certainly not just highlights these very real issues in climate and environmental justice, but really also how everything just comes together, right? Everything intersects, everything is interdisciplinary and, you know, intersectional. And the last, you know, few, you know, issues that you mentioned as well, as far as like academics needing to recognize, like, yeah, like we, you know, we have sort of a duty to be, you know, public facing, you know, and also and get that research out and also, you know, engage with the community and where it's reciprocal and symmetrical and, you know, tackle these global, you know, issues together. So thank you for that. And folks, again, thank you for listening. This is, again, Dr. Elaine Villanueva-Bernal, with WCET Frontiers Pod. And again, we just had Dr. Michael Mendez, talk to us about climate change, as far as how we really need to come together as, you know, in research, academia, politics, and community together. So with that, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.